Well, good evening, everybody, and appreciate everyone who comes out in the rain. Actually, it's been, sort of like challenging to sense what I wanted to share tonight. I feel so grateful for this three-week experience, but I have to say that the word intensive is really fitting, because I feel like in 3 weeks I lived years of, you know, sort of gifts of realizations and insights, and yet, you know, I have to keep reminding myself that whatever comes into consciousness is just sort of like a visitation, or, you know, sort of a moment of an appearance, but it's really not the whole thing. The Buddha mind lives in stillness and lives in the unconstructed wisdom. And so whatever I was given that came into my awareness is not the whole thing. And so I feel like the seeds of what I experienced are still very deep down. And at one point during the 3 weeks, this sort of loud voice came up and said, you know, the bread's still rising. So I feel like all what I want to just offer is just a few themes that seem to weave through my experience, and Oscar was there too, maybe the themes that were weaving through the intensive for many people, because Reb Anderson was our teacher, and, you know, he's really does a wonderful job, so to speak, of, you know, carrying a theme through, you know, the whole time, so that you're really practicing with it. You're not just listening to the words. But I just was remembering in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, it says, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Naturally real, yet inconceivable. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. This is the activity of the Dharma. It's inconceivable. And so let's all sort of live there too as we share this evening. The first theme, I guess I want to name again, actually it was last year when I was there that it really sunk in when Reb Anderson said, Zazen is a body practice. Our whole body lives the Dharma. It's our feelings, it's our thoughts, it's our body movements, it's our behaviors, it's our hesitations, it's our resistances, it's all of that. I learned while I was there that in the chapter 2 of the Shobo Genzo, Dogen says, when Avalokiteshvara practices the Prajnaparamita, the whole body reflects the five aggregates. And it turns out that word whole body, Dogen added. So that's part of, I think, his contribution is the sense of the whole body moving towards enlightenment. And at one point there was like, I'm a kind of a shy person, and there was a lot of people around, and most of whom I didn't know, and I was kind of overwhelmed. I didn't really want to talk to anybody. And the next thing I know, I noticed that I walked over and sat next to this other man who was also sort of alone and away on this brick fence. And I went over and I said, can I sit next to you? I'm really a shy person. Let's don't talk. And he said, yeah, I'm a shy person too. So I just sat there. And then in about 3 minutes, I don't know, I just stood up and I walked back in the crowd and I started talking to people. So to me, that was like, okay, somehow my body got me to where I needed to be. so that I could open more. So that was just one of the profound gifts of even being a Green Gulch farm, because you have to move, you have to live fully. I mean, you eat Oriyoki meals and you go in the dining room and you walk around every day. And I was on the grounds crew, so even though it was pouring down rain, I was out there, you know, digging ditches to redirect the streams that were, flooding down the roads. I was running down the creek to find out whether salmon were running. I was like splitting wood. I mean, so, and every moment I had that say, okay, am I fully engaged or not? You know, what's happening that's in the way of my being fully engaged? And so this whole sense of the whole body reflects that the five aggregates are empty. That too was just very alive, especially because it rained and it wind blew and it stormed and the electricity went off and then the sun came out and it was just very wild, I guess. But I wanted us to chant the hymn, The Fraction of Wisdom, tonight, because we chanted this every morning for 3 weeks. And the last part of it just became very profound to me, which, if you remember, we just chanted it. She herself, perfection of wisdom, is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. The perfection of the wisdom of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of dharma. So that was this question. Okay, what is that setting in motion the wheel of dharma? And I began to realize, and I'll say a little more about what Reb said about this, but that in every encounter we have with each other, there's the possibility that, especially if we're in our practice, that the Buddha mind will speak through each other. So actually the first day that we were there, the Tanto announced that the rules have changed, and even during days off, we can have no visitors. So, well, last year, John came to visit, and we had already planned that he was going to come visit. So it's sort of like already, it's like, okay, how do I feel about asking John not to come? And I sat with it for a while, and for several reasons, I didn't feel okay about it. So I went to the Eno to talk to her and said, well, you know, when we made this plan and, you know, how rigid is this rule? And so she said, well, you better talk to Reb about it, write him a note. And so I said, well, okay. But just as we were disengaging, she turned around and she said, but I'm sure he'll say yes, because your situation is that you're married. And there was something about the tone in her voice. This is your situation. I want to honor your situation. But this isn't my situation. I'm a priest. I'm single. I live here. She didn't say all this, but this was in her tone. My situation is different. But she said it in such a way that I could feel she's completely contented with her life as it is. And so that gave me this question to live with this whole time. What does it mean to be contented with the life we're given? What does it mean to be contented with life? So to me, this was the turning of the wheel of dharma. Something turned in this interaction so that at least I received a gift. And I don't really know much about her personally. So none of that information came because she talked to me about her life, you know. So this happened in another context where it was announced that this other priest had just gone through Shuso. Now, I didn't know this other priest at all, but I'd sort of heard rumors about him. It's kind of funny the way everybody talks. But I had sort of this impression that this Shuso had been a long time coming. And, you know, I mean, the message is let go of gaining mind. Let go of striving for something. Let go of having a project for your life. But that's not so easy. But somehow, in this moment, I felt, oh, all this time, without that dream, he was free. That we can be free right now, no matter what's happening in our life. So again, I don't know if I'm communicating, but this felt again like the wheel of Dharma turning. This came through the whole context of what was happening. And it was a message to me. Somehow I needed to know that, to hear that. So to carry this on, Reb, I think almost every time he gave a talk, talked about his strong understanding of what he calls face-to-face transmission. And this relates to our theme of working with our diversity statement, too, because he's saying that it's in our actual engagement, well, with everything, you know, walls, trees, rocks, stones, but people, in our face-to-face communication, we bring our face of our conditioned life, our personal life, and we bring our Buddha face to each other. And so there's this potential in every moment for meeting each other just where we are in our lives, but in a way that we listen and speak our truth, that then the Buddha mind can open and work. And he said, I hadn't heard this really, he said, Buddha does not practice alone. He practices with another Buddha. Our practice, whether sitting on the pillow or engaging in the world, is meant to be a conversation that pivots between our conditioned self to the unconditioned. Buddha is nothing in himself. All phenomena do not exist on its own. So in this face-to-face transmission, we bring our conditioned selves and we see each other as our teachers to show us what we don't see, and then the precepts naturally arise. You know, turning of the wheel of Dharma and this face-to-face transmission that Reb was talking about, it all seemed to kind of fit together. So then he told this koan, and this koan says, as the world honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, Steve, notice, this is the spot to build a sanctuary. And Indra actually came at this moment, and she took a blade of grass and stuck it in the ground and said, the sanctuary is built. Now, I don't know, this koan isn't literally, you know, walking with your friends and building a sanctuary. We're not really talking about building a building, but that whatever's happening between us, we welcome it and we build a sanctuary around it. And in building this sanctuary, a blade of grass emerges. Life can open. So this is very powerful because we hear this message all the time that we welcome everything that arises. We assume whatever arises, it's for the benefit of all beings. But often we don't like what arises, or we don't know how to deal with it, like anger arises or disgust. But Reb kept saying, build a sanctuary around it. So one morning I was like, I don't know, in my zazen, some sort of crazy thing about my mother was going on, and I was like, you know, sort of preoccupied with it. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the words came, build a sanctuary around every thought. And that was like an amazing thing. And all of a sudden, I started singing this song, like, we walk with beauty before me. We walk with beauty behind me. We walk with beauty around me. As we walk the beauty way. So kind of what blew my mind was that here I was ranting about my mother, and then I built this sanctuary, and then the song came. And then it was like, oh, that's how I want to live. I want to walk the beauty way. But then it was like, well, you know, and it does say in the Jhelumir Samadhi, the Buddha mind responds to inquiry. So I said, well, how do I do that? And then it was like, let go of every idea you have about what it means to walk the beauty way. And then it was like, phew, everything opened. So I guess I'm sharing this to give you this sense of the power of building a sanctuary. I have 5 minutes left. Okay. So because in that building of a sanctuary, something pivots and something opens. I guess maybe the last thing I'll share is I guess I learned a lot about how quickly I can take something that's arising and start to make it into something else. And then what happens if I really try to let go of words? So, like, one day I was on the grounds crew, and this young 27-year-old guy who was living at Green Gulch, we were supposed to go together to, like, trek down this creek and look for the salmon and make this little bridge out of wood. And he was, like, leaping forward, and, you know, I was like, trying to catch up, and I it was a horrible experience. I felt weak, I felt decrepit, I felt so old, and you know, I immediately started thinking about, oh, I better go work out on weights when I get home, and I went on. So, but then it's like, no, wait, just stay with decrepit, just stay with weak. And then the next day, I was decided to go split wood. And then that day, I had to lift up these big, like, trunks of wood to put in the, you know, the split wood splitter thing. But that day, I was strong. I picked them up and I put them down. And it was like this amazing thing. It's like, what do our minds do with what arises so that we can't just be with what's here and then let it go? Because then that's what allows something else to come. So as Reb says, don't push ahead and don't pull back. Don't push ahead and don't pull back. For listening.
What she said. kept a journal during the retreat, which I haven't done before. And I was really glad that I did, because a lot of things you experience, that I experienced, I think that one experiences, the experience is evanescent. It's sort of interesting, maybe an unusual frame of mind or some thought, but when it's happening, it's just, oh, yeah, that's unusual, that's good, it's good that I saw that. But there's not much incentive to, oh, I got to really remember that. But maybe a day later or an hour later, I'll think, oh, maybe I should write that down. I guess I'll write that down. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And then later, going back to it, oh, I'm glad I wrote that down. I forgot that happened. Mm-hmm. And particularly it was interesting to see how my practice or my experience developed and changed over the time of the retreat. Before I go on, though, with that, I wonder if it would be of interest to talk about sort of the objective reality of how it was to be there, of what went on during the day and so forth. Yeah? Okay, it might be, for those of you who are familiar, have been there, or something similar, it may not be, it won't be anything new, for the most part. So the schedule, we were there for 3 weeks, 21 days. The first 16 days were intensive, and that involved about 6 to 7 hours of sitting. Not all of that was zazen. Most of it was zazen, but also included orioki meals and later. And during the sesshin, also tea and sitting for the talks. During the sesshin, that was up to about 11 hours a day of sitting. We got up at 4:25 and we sat, and the day ended, the last sitting ended at, I think, 8:55, something like that. Basically, 4:30 to 9. We had every day during the intensive part, not the sesshin, a 2-hour work period. Doralee mentioned she was on grounds crew. My assignment was to work in the guest house where Doralee and I and others were staying. And that was kind of neat, you know, it meant tidying stuff up and restocking the snack area. But it was busy. You know, work period is busy. You're like moving quickly. And I was often confronted with how inefficient I was at new tasks, at things I hadn't done before and had to figure out the most efficient way to do something. And it was lovely because I was working with a resident. Her name was Katrina, a woman from Switzerland. And so we worked together pretty much for 2 hours every day. And at the end, I think we both felt really warmly for each other. She was telling me in describing her experience of being a resident how the hard part is that people come and go all the time. People always moving through. I also had some other assignments, as many others did. I was in the Doan Ryo there, and I was assigned to be Shoten. It's a position we don't have here, but it involves managing the door to the zendo and ringing various bells and drums at different times. It was one of the... I entered the retreat with in not a very good, in sort of a negative frame of mind. I wasn't, and it took me a long time to settle. And one of my early unsettling experiences was, as Shoten, one of my cues to hit a drum, to get up from the pillow and move to a drum and hit it, was the striking of a match by the Doan. Well, the Doan has a clock. He knows when to strike the match just before the end of the period. But this was early when we got there, when this 25-year reoccurrence storm was happening. And the rain was just beating down on the flat roof of the Zendo, you know, constantly. And the wind outside was bending the trees. They were thrashing back and forth in all in different synchronicities. So they were like, it was like this. Big eucalyptus and redwoods. And down in the bottom of the gulch, oaks. And some of these trees were uprooting. I saw at least three big trees, you know, like this, that were uprooted and fallen. One of them right doing damage on the grounds to buildings. So it was hard to hear a match strike, you know, in the big Zendo. And I was like really anxious and paranoid and not knowing how I was going to ensure I would not hear it. In fact, I didn't hear it because it wasn't Shoten every day. It was about every fifth day. So that worked out. As it happened, the Doan the Doan seat was available since he was Doan, and it was right near where the Doan sits, and so I could actually hear him rustle, get up, and listen for the match. But it was. It took me. Oh, I didn't know that the timer would go away. It took me at least half of the entire retreat before I began to stabilize, and I wasn't sleeping well either. And, you know, I was thinking, well, what am I doing here? I definitely am the poorest Zen student here. And I certainly don't want to see red in this state and embarrass myself with no intelligent questions to ask, nothing to say except, I don't know what I'm doing. It's really a bummer. And in my journal, it's like, I think on the 25th of January, 3 days before the end of Sesshin, after having been there for almost 3 weeks, I said, meditation fairly stable. So it was a while. Although I'd had, actually, many things were happening. I also served on serving crew, which was great, as usual. For one good thing about it, means I missed about two sessions of zazen, and as a result, I had no major problems sitting with discomfort. It was manageable, and I never had to use a chair. We and I served. Five times, about every 5 days, doing Orioke, which is a marvelous experience. It's a marvelous experience in working together in teamwork. We had, I think, three personal days off where we woke up at 6 o'clock, like the night before we could party. And there are only two zazen sittings, and the rest of the day was basically free. I went on hikes on two of those days, once with Dora Lee up on the, in the ridge, on the ridges, and once with another participant. And we had Wi-Fi. This will be news to some of you, but there was Wi-Fi, good Wi-Fi, in the guest house. And some of us, I know, did use it to listen to news, to read the news, to stay abreast of the news of the day. There was much happening in that time period. And to check emails. We went on a, we participated in a march on, in support of the Women's March on January 21st. Fu organized a march from Green Gulch to the beach. About, I think, 30 people participated, something like that, a good number, many of the residents and participants. And it was a good experience, and the surf was amazing. Although it was not raining that day, the storms were out there and the surf was just crashing, and the whole experience was very evocative of the dragon energy in that area. Green Gulch is, its Japanese name is Green Dragon Temple, and it was easy to see the dragon energy. The steam rising from the hillside when the sun hit it, the fog just coiling and swirling, the rain, the trees. It was very impressive. After about four or five days, I did start to experience some loosening of my negative feelings, and someone asked me about it, and I said, "Oh, it's better." And they said, "What happened?" And I said, "I gave up hope." And then I said, "This word just came," and I found I didn't need it, and that was useful to me because it was the first indication, oh, maybe something is happening here. Maybe I can survive this. I still didn't want to see Reb, but then he told his story, which he tells, I think, every time, about how Suzuki Roshi sent him to train to chant from a Japanese professional chanter, priest. And then he said, he asked Reb to chant for him, to show him what he had learned. And Reb chanted, and Suzuki Roshi was like saying, "That's great, but that's how a 60-year-old Japanese person chants, Japanese monk chants. You chant this way, like Reb." And he was instructing Reb, and Reb wanted to escape that situation. It was too intense. Even though he was there to study with Suzuki Roshi, and Suzuki Roshi was giving him his attention, Reb just wanted to get away. "Oh, I've taken enough of your time, Roshi." "No, that's okay. You can stay." And Reb always tells that story, I think, because to give comfort to people such as I, who sometimes feel that they don't want to see the teacher. So then I thought, "Oh, now I've got to go see him." And I did, and I told him what was happening. And I remembered, "Oh, this is what happens every time at Seishin." Later on, in one of the features of the retreat was small group discussions about once a week. or actually when we had days at the end of the days off. And Tracy, some of you know, I told this story in the small group, and Tracy said that's just what happened to her. And when she went in and told Reb about it, he said the value, or maybe Tracy came up with this herself, the value is in confessing that to Reb, and just bringing that into reality, your own personal reality, rather than denying it. These two concepts, these two themes that Reb presented to us, every place is a good place to build a sanctuary, and face-to-face meeting and transmission, both grew as concepts, as I think they did for Dora Lee. As I worked with them and heard Reb discussing them further, they became universal. From first the concept of teacher to student, which is how I entered that concept, and then both teacher and student having an attitude of full responsibility and presence, and then how people influence each other, and then the transcendent way everything supports everything else, and finally how our limited, conditioned way of relating to each other opens to the transcendent way in which everything supports everything else. Not so much supports everything else, because that implies like different things supporting each other, but really is everything else, because that support is so intimate and intrinsic and can't be any other way. At some point it became clear to me that my mind, the grasping quality of my mind, and how that inhibited my relationships with other people, and how it was different than a mind that was clear of thoughts and grasping. And how that mind, it came to me in a visualization, is pure and shining and spacious. And it's occupied by its objects. They just come and pass through. But they're not to be confused with reality. They're just the appearance of things, the way my particular karma presents my perceptions to me. So that really opens up my relationship to the objects of my mind, because it frees them, it liberates them from pretending to be real, and it liberates me from believing them and being anchored, trapped in that narrow, limited perception of their appearance. And it opens up the question of what is the actuality of the objects if what my perception of them is not accurate. And that's an imponderable, unanswerable question, and it supports the attitude which Dora Lee spoke of just opening curiosity, and of not needing there to be an answer. Because really, there's no question. It's all right here, right now. So this kind of talk is really great because there's so much to say. I didn't have to worry about shaping the talk to the available time. I just would talk until the time was up, and that's now. Oh, so Doralee, we've left some time for discussion and questions, if there are any. I have some.
I just had a question for Doralee.
Yeah.
Did you really sing that song out loud when you were doing all that?
I didn't sing it out loud.
It was in your mind, okay.
I didn't sing it direct, though.
Okay.
No, it was.
Did you make it up on the spot?
No, I...
The song, did you make it up on the spot?
It's a Native American chant.
Oh.
So, I mean, I didn't make it up. I'd already heard it and it came to me. Yeah.
Why don't you sit up there so you can be recorded?
Actually, you know, Reb gave us the whole thing about excitement. That excitement can be, you know, like a hindrance sometimes because you get carried away with it. And this actually happened when this whole song thing came, and, you know, then more things opened up about beauty, and I was like so excited. And I like wanted to run and tell Rep right away because it was so great. But of course, you never can run and have Dokusan with him right away. You have to wait until you're called. And so then I began to realize that all my sitting was involved with rehearsing everything that I wanted to say. I didn't want to forget because I was so excited. So then I realized, oh, I have to let go of my excitement. I have to let go of all the words so that I can be here now. So it was very powerful. So I went and talked to him about just that excitement can actually stop the wheel of Dharma from turning. So because after all of that, I sat on my cushion after I let it all go, and then all of a sudden I was just a tree stump. You know, it was like, I'm just here. And it was so powerful. But then he said, don't hold on to excitement, but don't get rid of excitement either, because excitement's also a wonderful thing. So that was a really great sort of whole thing there.
I'd like to add a similar an experience, which is really related to that. I had the same reaction to some of the insights or thoughts that I'd had, and I was excited, and I spent time formulating questions excitedly, but I never had the realization that you did. I went with this excitement to Rev and asked these questions, and he was singularly uninformative and unhelpful. And he just, used his skill at verbalization to turn all my questions inside out, and like put them out there in like a cloud of Zen talk speak, which,
right.
And I left really like feeling unfulfilled and sort of put on too, put upon. And then a day later, or half a day later, the next day, I realized, oh yeah, I went with him. I went to him trying to get something. I was trying to get something, and I remembered all the stories he always tells for the benefit of people such as myself about students who are trying to get stuff from their teachers. And feeling that they are not getting it. and not realizing until the end of the case that they have been getting it all along. The transmission has been occurring all the time. They just weren't open for it. Mm-hmm. Steve, did you have a question?
I don't know about the physical condition of your body, but was there danger that you would get like hurt,
swept away,
working, carrying heavy tree stumps? I mean, it seems to me like, I mean, I don't know about that.
I think I was careful not to do anything that felt dangerous to me.
Right.
I wouldn't have. I mean, that was part of what I was working with. I didn't want to go beyond what was, you know, feasible for me. But it was hard when I was in my, you know, old age and working with people who were very young. It sort of highlighted, you know, my aging. But at the same time, it was also something that I was like creating in my mind too. So, but no, somebody else had that reaction too. Well, you shouldn't be out there picking up those tree stumps.
You must have trusted your judgment even when you were in that crucible of a situation.
Uh-huh.
Like all her judgments going to remain good.
Yeah, I hope they were trusting my judgment. Karen?
Puzzling over sanctuary.
How did I understand that, or
yeah,
something? Well, I guess I heard it as this sort of deep capacity to reverently honor whatever is here, and to do it in such a way that you pause and you actually create a kind of space around what's there without judgment. So it's an honoring, really, honoring whatever is here. And in that honoring, then, that's when the pivoting can happen, when something new can come, because you're accepting everything. So he actually, there was one point where we were, he was offering a suggestion to the whole group of us, and a lot of people were reacting to what he was saying. So, you know, it wasn't like, oh yeah, yay, let's do that. You know, people said, I don't like that idea, or I'm uncomfortable with it, or, you know, people had a lot of different reactions. And he was very much present, and he said, I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to build a sanctuary around what each person is saying. So it was very interesting to watch this whole process, because people were very honest, and yet you didn't feel that anybody was being discounted or reacted to. So that was kind of a way that I think he was, you know, actually trying to show how that could work. Yes. And I think he was meaning that, like, for example, if we're trying to have a conversation with somebody who voted for the president we didn't vote for, you know, like, how do we build a sanctuary around that kind of conversation so that actually maybe we could learn something from the other person rather than just react. So, does that make sense?
For me, I'd like to talk about that too, because it was a central theme of the retreat and a powerful teaching. For me, it was basically the same, but a little bit different. Mm-hmm. I changed it from this is a good place to build a sanctuary to this is a good moment to build a sanctuary, because moments happen like this. There can be many moments in one place, and with each moment can be a thought, and with each thought can be an affliction. And it's that affliction, that tear, that fear, as Reb put it, that's where the sanctuary building takes place. There. And for me, it was, and it just takes a moment, and then you're on to the next sanctuary, mm-hmm. if appropriate, if necessary. And the process of building the sanctuary is just, as Dora Lee said, being with that problem, that affliction. In being with it, you remove its otherness. That's the problem, that there's this other than you, which is in conflict with what you perceive yourself to be, this object of yourself. And with that, when you're with the moment, then that conflict goes away. There may be an objective problem. Your foot may be hurting, you know, or whatever. Someone may be bugging you. But you're just, you're just responding rather than having the conflict. And it helps to remember to be content, as Dora Lee said. You don't need to be upset. And I caught myself being upset with people sometimes, and it just, I don't need to be upset. I can just be entertained. there's no conflict here. So it was really, and it took me, you know, several weeks of working with this and hearing it before I got to the point where I am now. I don't know where I'll be in another week, but mm-hmm. it's a nice thing to work with.
It's 10 to 9, so I realize we're going over time, Jim.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.